chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, says Israel's evil acts will draw it closer to collapse. Iran stresses the need for a regional security system established by all countries in the Persian Gulf region. Also, Latin America remains one of the hotspots of the coronavirus pandemic, with Brazil registering nearly 29,000 new cases and over 1,100 more deaths. Beginning with our top story, the chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has warned that the Islamic Republic will respond strongly to any act of mischief by Israel. Major General Hossein Salami made the remarks in an interview with Lebanon's Arabic language Al Mayadeen television news network. Salami added that the acts of mischief by the Israeli regime in the region would expose it to real threats in the future. The top commander warned that the evil acts of the regime will backfire and draw it closer to collapse. Political commentator Firas Al-Najim says the international community is silent about the Israeli regime's atrocities and human rights violations.
The Zionist regime is backed up and supported and armed by, you know, all kind of governments in the world and regimes. And they have a green light to do whatever they want and to hit what they want. And nobody is ever penalizing them and holding them accountable. Right. We see United Nations. Is silent about the Israeli atrocities, their human rights violations, their their breaches of airspace in Lebanon, in Syria, even in Iraq. I mean, these people, they don't have any respect for any law, and they think that they can get away with it. We see clearly the IRGC Quds Force commander when they killed Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. We see when he came out that time and he gave a statement and a declaration, and he had the flags of all the resistance groups, Hamas, Ansar Allah in Yemen. So this obviously was coordinated with all these resistance groups. So now this alliance is very well-equipped, very strongly working together, and the Zionist regime knows this, and they are surrounded by resistance, and not normal resistance. We're talking about resistance that has been resisting for years and years and helped liberate, like for instance Hezbollah. They liberated Lebanon from the Israeli occupation and from any other intrusions or invasions.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has held talks with Iraq's prime minister, Mustafa al-Kazemi, in Baghdad. The two officials reaffirmed their commitments to boost bilateral ties and advance mutual interests of Tehran and Baghdad. They also discussed an ongoing effort to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and issues related to cooperation in the fields of economy, commerce, transport, and fighting terrorism. Zarif also met with Iraqi President Barham Saleh. The top Iranian diplomat underlined the importance of the security of the Persian Gulf region with the participation of all regional countries, as proposed by President Hassan Rouhani, dubbed the Hormuz Peace Initiative. Kazemi, for his part, said Iraq doesn't perceive Iran merely a neighbor, but also a strategic partner. Author and political commentator Kevin Barrett says the United States' influence fades. Countries in West Asia should work together to establish regional security.
The region is going to have to work this out for itself. The American presence is weakening as the empire draws down, as the Americans turn to what they see as a mortal threat from united Russia and especially China, and face China's economic rise and China's move to become a regional power. That's going to take up the Americans' attention. They won't be able to focus on their games in Iraq much longer. So in the long run, Iran is the most important strategic partner for Iraq. And as events move forward, the Iraqis, I think, understand this more and more. And the Americans have lost their chess game in that part of the world. So I would expect that this new peace initiative would very likely lead to something very productive.
Latin America remains one of the hot spots of the coronavirus pandemic, with Brazil being the worst hit nation in the region. Brazil has registered over 1,100 new COVID deaths and over 28,600 additional cases. The figures pushed the country's death tally to nearly 400,000 out of 14.3 million confirmed cases. Meanwhile, Mexico has reported over 1,100 new cases and 116 more deaths. This brings its total caseload to over 2.3 million, while fatalities are hovering around 215,000. Peru has also registered 433 deaths in a single day, bringing the tally to almost 60,000. The Andean nation, with some 33 million population, has reported over 1.7 million cases so far. Several UN agencies, including the World Health Organization, have warned that millions of ailing children are at risk whose immunizations have been disrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic.
The pandemic has caused several disruptions to immunization services around the world. New WHO data shows that as a result of COVID-19, 60 immunization campaigns are currently suspended in 50 countries. That means about 228 million children are vulnerable right now.
The agency said the children, especially in Africa, are in danger of life-threatening diseases such as measles, polio, yellow fever, and diphtheria. They noted that gaps in vaccination coverage have already led to serious measles outbreaks in Pakistan and Yemen. They said such a scenario could likely lead to more epidemics as regular childhood vaccinations are missing. The executive director of the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, also warned that routine immunization services remain disrupted in many countries. Henrietta Forrest said the world was losing ground in the fight against preventable child illness, or I should say illnesses, even before the outbreak of the coronavirus. Political commentator Abayomi Azikiwe says the COVID-19 pandemic has to stop before any immunization plan proceeds, and this could happen through a coordinated international plan.
What has happened with the advent of COVID-19 and the development of various vaccines, there is what the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, has said, vaccine nationalism has set in, and there's a lot of hoarding of vaccinations in Western countries, in Western Europe and North America. And I think the World Health Organization is speaking on this as well as the United Nations. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is in Central Africa, there's been a spike in measles outbreaks, something that is clearly preventable. Overall, the rate of vaccines, the number, overall number of vaccines administered are down tens of millions of doses. And the COVID-19 pandemic has to be arrested internationally, but it cannot be arrested if the Western countries are not sharing or not, if there's no international plan for equitable distribution of vaccinations to get the virus under control. The virus has to be brought under control initially. Then we could have the rollout of other vaccination programs, because what's happening is that the COVID-19 problem is creating additional public health crises among children and even among adults.
Pressure is mounting on the United States to lift a patent-related restriction, giving other nations access to develop COVID-19 vaccines and treatments for the respiratory disease. It comes down to the priorities: saving lives or making a profit. So far, the U.S. has opted to make profits at the expense of innocent lives while hoarding the vaccine for its own citizens.
The deadly and highly contagious novel coronavirus has had a huge impact on billions of people's lives, weighing down on the economy, putting workers out of work around the globe, and more. After gaining an understanding of the virus, countries around the world began developing their versions of a COVID-19 vaccine.
It's called Operation Warp Speed. That means big and it means fast. A massive scientific, industrial, and logistical endeavor unlike anything our country has seen since the Manhattan Project.
The United States, under former President Donald Trump, launched a vaccine program dubbed Operation Warp Speed and invested heavily in producing, delivering, and distributing the jabs. The program proved successful, and the country produced different vaccines for the disease. But under patent-related restrictions, it prevented other nations from having access to the know-how to produce life-saving vaccines at home. With Donald Trump gone, President Joe Biden is now facing increasing pressure to issue a waiver for the restrictions. Several Democratic leaders, including Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, have joined a petition with 2 million signatures demanding that the U.S. administration drop its support of a World Trade Organization agreement that bars other countries from accessing the patents. Charity organization Oxfam has called the current situation of the distribution of jabs in the world as vaccine apartheid, noting that the world is dealing with a public health emergency and that the pandemic isn't a private profit opportunity.
The fact that the U.S. does not want to remove a patent on some of its key vaccine developments against COVID-19 is another symbol of how this empire is ruled by profits, by money, by the pursuit of wealth against everything else. It doesn't care about human life. It doesn't care about human beings and their health and prosperity. It cares about money because the United States worships money. Its God is money. And it's something that's horrible to understand because we're in the middle of overcoming a pandemic that is still very much a threat to a lot of people around the world.
The comments come ahead of shareholder meetings for the giant pharmaceutical company.
Estimates show the big pharma has generated about $26 billion in revenue since the start of the pandemic, enough to vaccinate everyone living on the African continent. At the same time, international organizations are raising the alarm about vaccine hoarding by rich nations, warning that such practices would threaten the fight against the deadly disease.
According to data from Johns Hopkins University, people in the United States have received approximately a quarter of total vaccines administered around the globe. Other wealthier nations in the world have also received significantly higher numbers of vaccines compared to middle and low-income countries. A Washington Post report indicates the United States will have an oversupply of hundreds of millions of coronavirus vaccine doses as soon as July. The figure has raised concerns about possible hoarding in the country. Earlier this month, Amnesty International condemned richer countries for failing a, quote, rudimentary test of global solidarity by hoarding COVID vaccines, accusing them of exploiting the pandemic to undermine human rights. Also, the World Health Organization warned richer countries that their deals with big pharmaceutical companies will hurt the global COVAX program for poorer nations. The UN agency says its plan to roll out 1.3 billion doses of vaccine to low and middle-income nations by the end of this year has been slow, as wealthier nations are approaching vaccine manufacturers that the COVAX program is counting on.
We can't expect these big countries like the United States, like the United Kingdom, to save us, because they haven't, and we're seeing that happen as we speak. We're seeing these first world developed countries hoard access to medicine and vaccines that can potentially save the lives of millions of people around the world. And the only way we're going to get around this is developing the means of production, developing infrastructure, doing what Iran is doing, what China is doing, what Venezuela and Cuba and Russia and others are doing, and creating pharmaceutical industries that are not dependent on Pfizer, not dependent on Moderna, not dependent on Johnson & Johnson, but are shared technologies by all people around the world.
We're in the middle of a pandemic that has spread to every country in the world. Unless all the Earth's 8 billion inhabitants are vaccinated, the novel coronavirus is expected to stay with us for much longer.
The U.S. Justice Department has announced a probe into Louisville police after an officer there fatally shot African-American woman Breonna Taylor last year.
Today, the Justice Department is opening a civil investigation into the Louisville-Jefferson County Metro Government and the Louisville Metro Police Department to determine whether LMPD engages in a pattern or practice of violations of the Constitution or federal law.
The Attorney General added the investigation will also focus on whether the police conduct is racially motivated. Taylor was caught in the crossfire during a police raid on her apartment in March last year. The probe comes within a week after a similar investigation was launched into the Minneapolis Police Department. That after former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of killing George Floyd. The death of Floyd and Taylor sparked a new wave of nationwide protests against racial profiling and police brutality in the U.S. That's your board news for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Republican Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt has signed a new law that would grant protections for drivers who hit and kill protesters while attempting to drive away from a protest, and implements harsher penalties on people who block roads or highways during a protest. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Sharon Jung Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Oklahoma Governor Signs Law Granting Immunity for Drivers Who Kill Protesters. Here's more. Republican Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt has signed a new law that would grant protections for drivers who hit and kill protesters while attempting to drive away from a protest, and implements harsher penalties on people who block roads or highways during a protest. Democrats and activists decried the law as stifling protestant citizens' First Amendment rights. HB 1674, which Republican legislators passed earlier this week, grants civil and criminal immunity for drivers who unintentionally harm or kill protesters while fleeing from a riot, as long as there is a reasonable belief that fleeing was necessary. This legislation is not about safety, said Nicole McAfee, Director of Policy and Advocacy at Oklahoma American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, in a statement recently. It is about centering the convenience of people who already have the power and protections of the law. It is about responding to calls for transparency by protesters and the media with the criminalization of those transparency efforts, it added. broad language in the law may allow for clashing interpretations on how protections are granted. Without a definition in the bill for what circumstances would be deemed necessary or unintentional, the bill leaves the language up to potentially broad interpretation. Brandon Tucker, policy director of the ACLU in Tennessee, noted the danger of laws with such broad language on CNN when talking about similar legislation being considered by legislators in Tennessee that would grant immunity to drivers who unintentionally kill protesters and criminalize certain forms of protest. This vague and troubling suppression of free speech can easily be abused, leading to the criminalization of protesters' words and beliefs, Tucker said. The bill also increases penalties for protesters who block roadways during a protest. It makes blocking a roadway a misdemeanor, punishable by up to a year in prison and a hefty $5,000 fine. In the wake of nationwide protests for Black Lives, many have said the bill is racist and seeks to push harsher penalties on oppressed people who often need to protest in order to make their voices heard. Oklahoma State Senator Kevin Matthews, a Democrat, denounced the bill. "It's not right that we are trying to keep people from protesting when African Americans are killed unarmed," Matthews told the Oklahoma Man. "In this state, it is oftentimes the marginalized voices that aren't oftentimes heard, and these are why they do the protest that they have done." Young Democrats of America president and Oklahoma man Joshua Harris told Public Radio Tulsa last month. The bill comes as Republicans are pushing through a wave of anti-protest legislation across the U.S. Just in this legislative session, the GOP has filed 81 anti-protest laws in 34 states as backlash against the growing movement for Black Lives. Many, such as the bill just passed in Florida, similarly grant protections to drivers who harm protesters. Others seek harsh penalties on protesters and widen the definition of the word riot in order to target demonstrators. These bills talk about riots, but the language that they use is so sweeping that it encompasses way more than what people imagine. Ely Page, legal advisor for International Center for Nonprofit Law, told USA Today. "Many bills," Page said, "criminalize legitimate First Amendment-protected protests. Some bills also target low-income protesters by making them ineligible for government aid like student loans and food stamps if they are convicted with protest-related charges. It's so devious, selectively silencing people," Page told USA Today. "This is the kind of penalty that really impacts certain communities, not others." Republicans are likely passing these bills with the knowledge that right-wing protesters are much less likely to face violence and hostility from law enforcement than left-wing protesters are. Many of the states considering anti-protest laws already have punishments for rioting, so activists have been left to speculate about what Republicans are actually trying to achieve. "These anti-freedom policies are passed with a veil over their true intention," said Tamia Coxtor, executive director of the Oklahoma ACLU, in a statement about the recently passed law, adding that the laws aim to chill speech, criminalize accountability, and let us all know that a majority of the legislature cares more about protecting the deadly power of the state than they do about rights and liberties or even public safety.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us begin the day by reflecting on a supplication in the Divine Court, taught to us by Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, the sixth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. O Allah, Lord of the month of Ramadan and revealer of the Quran, this is the month of Ramadan, in which you sent down the Quran and sent down in it manifest proofs of guidance and the criterion. O Allah, assist me to carry out its fasting and devotions. Deliver it to us intact. Keep us sound and healthy during it, and receive it intact from us in ease and well-being from you.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
خیلی مواظب باشیم تو این ماه آدم حرمت همسفره‌ای‌های دیگری که تو این ماه هستن رو حفظ
کنه. One of the important points to keep in mind during the holy month of Ramadan is having respect for the people around us. The best deed during this month is this. We do many good deeds during this month, but we must be careful not to pollute our actions by committing sins. One of such sins is violating the rights of others through disrespecting them. In a story, we read that once a man was leaving the holy shrine of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam one early morning when suddenly he saw an old man singing this poem.
Thank you.
ز خود هرگز نرنجانم دلی را که می ترسم در آن جای تو باشد. بعد بگفتش که
I will not insult the heart of anyone because that heart might be the place of God. And then the old man said, Oh God, oh God. The man asked the old one, Are you serious? And the answer was, Yes, I repeat this sentence up to the moment God hears me. The lesson we can learn from the poem recited by the old man is that we must not disrespect anyone because his or her heart will be closer to the abode of Allah. During the month of Ramadan, we must be more careful. We must be more concerned about the hearts of other believers. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
When spring arrives, nature is lively and in bloom. This generous season brings with it merriment for humans and animals alike, as they can freely enjoy the greenery. A herd of cows in Sweden have gotten their first chance to graze in green open fields after being cooped up in their farms for the whole winter due to the harsh cold. The event was broadcast live so people could enjoy watching these happy animals springing around. Sweden's traditional cow release ceremony attracts thousands of visitors every year.
Barcelona's famous Casa Batlló has been decorated with hundreds of artificial red roses on the occasion of St. George's Day, a Christian celebration also known as the Feast of St. George. For those in Catalonia, the floral decoration of Antoni Gaudí's architectural masterpiece means the arrival of spring. Many locals say that after a year of lockdown amid pandemic, the decoration seems like a recovery for them. Catalans normally celebrate the occasion in large groups outdoors, but this year, COVID-19 has prevented their traditional way of celebrations. However, they say Casa Batlló's roses have sparked a sense of enthusiasm that life is eventually going back to normal in some way. A Dutch photographer has captured stunning footage of a super yacht passing through narrow canals of the Netherlands. Tom van Usanen used a drone to record the transportation of the gigantic vessel from its initial facility to the North Sea. The 94 meters long yacht, known as Project 817, is one of the largest vessels to be launched this year. It has been designed to precisely fit the waterways, and even a few centimeters cannot be added to its length or width. The duration of the yacht's transportation also depends on a variety of factors, including winds and the schedule of the bridges. For this super yacht, the mission took 4 days to be completed. space radar capable of capturing small objects that threaten the safety of astronauts and satellites has been inaugurated at a farm in northwestern Costa Rica. The four large panels that make up the radar are connected to the servers of an aerospace company in San Francisco in the U.S. state of California. The system uses a continuous series of radio frequencies that bounce off materials in orbit and send information back to the servers. An American astronaut present at the ceremony says the radar is most advanced of its kind in the world.
Now this radar, which is the most advanced commercial radar for space tracking in the world, what it does is it sends radio signals into space. As Franklin said, even an object the size of a golf ball traveling at 30,000 kilometers per hour overhead, a tiny amount of those radio waves will bounce off it and can be picked up by these giant reflector dishes behind us.
Costa Rican President Carlos Alvarado also joined by American and domestic astronauts during the event. The radar can monitor objects that transit in low Earth orbit near the equator, an average or an advantage offered by Costa Rica's geographical location.
A museum in London has transformed its gift shop into a mini supermarket selling artist-designed food to help an industry largely affected by the coronavirus pandemic. The Design Museum has reopened its shop with the help of 10 artists. It sells essential products with packaging designed by emerging artists. The market offers goods at the same price of normal markets, both online and at a marketplace. The initiative is led by Camille Walala, who says her project is aimed at supporting the artists reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, the project is to support artists, and I think because obviously at the moment there's no exhibition, people can't really show any of their creative work, and it's nice to have like a feedback when you're creative. It's nice to know, you know, if people like your work. I think this is a really nice platform to just bring artwork on like everyday product, and actually people are going to probably come and just buy them and probably keep them as a piece of art, like, you know, an affordable piece of art from some artists that you like. I think it's a really nice way to display art, so yeah, I think.
Walala says the project also conveys the message that creativity is as important for living as the other essentials. She says the creative supermarket will also help the museum, which has seen a drop of more than 90% in income because of the pandemic. The shop is open for just 5 days, but artists expect heavy demand.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
In Hong Kong schools, robots are helping children with autism to live a better life. These robots are part of an educational program called Robot for Autism Behavioral Intervention, or RABI. It's designed for individuals with autism between 3 and 18 years of age and aims to make them more social. The robots engage the children with role-playing and verbal interaction, helping them to resolve issues such as conflicts and bullying. The program was developed by a Hong Kong professor, Catherine So. She says the program will help fight social deprivation of a certain group of people.
We would believe that RABI can help them to, you know, improve their social and behavioral skills, and in turn, enhancing their quality of their life. So to reduce being excluded in the society, and also help them to be included in the future.
Catherine says using robots also helps keep the program structured and predictable, as autistic people are hypersensitive to voices and facial expressions. The program she launched in 2015 has now been adopted in more than 20 nonprofit groups and public schools in the country. More than 1,200 children have used it so far.
The worldwide trends show people rapidly moving toward modern vehicles now, especially electric cars. But Parisians saw a very unusual kind of EV driving around the city, similar to the one people were using over a century ago. A replica of the 1881 vehicle by French inventor Gustave Prouve was made to celebrate what is regarded as the 140th anniversary of the first viable electric car. Prouve, who is believed to have driven the world's first electric car, combined a rechargeable battery and a cycle, something very similar to a modern e-bike. The car has a motor to assist you, but you can still pedal at the same time.
So Gustave Prouve, when he combined an electric motor, a rechargeable battery and a cycle very similar to this one, that would be one of the earliest, if not the earliest, electric vehicle to be seen on the roads.
A Victorian cycle engineer built the vehicle in North Yorkshire, England. It took him some 2 months to come up with the replica with materials that closely matched those used by Prouve himself. Like the original, it has an average speed of approximately 16 kilometers per hour. NASA's small helicopter has made history as it successfully completed its flight on Mars. Receiving instructions from Earth, Ingenuity managed to rise to about 3 meters, hovered for 30 seconds, and then landed on the red planet. The mission marked the first powered, controlled flight on another planet. The helicopter weighs only 1.8 kilograms, has four legs, and is powered by solar panels. Flying a helicopter on Mars is hard because there is not much air to push against to generate the necessary lift. A creative artist in Belgium has come up with an alternative to the face masks, a portable oasis. Alain Vercheron says the mini greenhouse allows him to connect with people while observing social distancing during the coronavirus pandemic. However, the idea is not new. It came to his mind 15 years ago, inspired by the lush oasis he encountered while working in Tunisia.
An oasis is a place of calm, tranquility, cool and well-being in the desert. Here, the fact of having an oasis containing medicinal plants means I am also protecting myself from harm coming from the outside, just like I could at an oasis in the middle of the desert.
Doesn't that look bizarre? Well, he says he has asthma and breathing with the device is easier than a face mask. The 61-year-old artist hopes his invention also raises awareness of environment protection. Pumas are solitary animals that do not usually get along well with humans. However, a Russian family has been living with an extraordinarily friendly mountain lion for 5 years. Now, Alexander and Maria Dmitriev bought little Messi from a zoo 5 years ago. The cat could barely walk then. With the tender care of the couple, he soon regained his strength. Messi's growth was stunted due to his malnutrition. Interestingly, the adorable puma has never shown any aggression toward humans. Well, looks very friendly. Messi's family has converted their home to meet his natural needs. They have also set up social media accounts for him on Instagram and YouTube, where he has millions of followers.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
After seven North Carolina deputies were placed on leave over the death of Andrew Brown Jr., an African-American man shot during the serving of a drug-related warrant, authorities in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, added to calls for body camera footage to be released. Reports have said Andrew Brown, a 42-year-old, was shot in the back on Wednesday, 21st of April, as he tried to drive away. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Edward Helmore. The piece is titled Andrew Brown Shooting, Seven North Carolina Deputies Placed on Leave. Stay with us for more of Edward Helmore's article. After seven North Carolina deputies were placed on leave over the death of Andrew Brown Jr., an African-American man shot during the serving of a drug-related warrant, authorities in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, added to calls for body camera footage to be released in this case. Reports have said Brown, a 42-year-old, was shot in the back on Wednesday, 21st of April, as he tried to drive away. In a press conference on Friday, 23rd of April, the Pasquotank County Sheriff, Tommy Wooten II, expressed condolences to Andrew Brown's family and pledged that if any deputies are found to have violated laws or policies, they will be held accountable. Tommy Wooten confirmed that at least one deputy was wearing an active body camera. No timetable was given for release of the body camera footage. Under North Carolina law, a judge must sign off on release of body camera footage, but the law also says anyone can file a petition seeking its release. News outlets have filed a petition to a local judge. The Andrew Brown family said they met with authorities but were not shown the footage. At a press conference on Saturday, officials including Betty Parker, the mayor of Elizabeth City, in North Carolina, joined calls for more information to be released in this case. Mayor of Elizabeth City, Betty Parker, said her lawyers had asked for the body camera footage. "We were told by our attorney that more than likely will not get it," she said, adding that she wanted the law surrounding disclosures of body camera footage changed as quickly as possible. The Elizabeth City manager, Montrey Freeman, said he would hope and trust the sheriff's office would release more information about this case. "I'm trying with everything in me to believe that they're going to do the right thing," Montrey Freeman said. "I truly believe that the sheriff will once that information is ready. But time is truly of the essence, and I'm going to just focus on protecting people as we work through this process." Tommy Wooten has said deputies, including a tactical team, were attempting to serve drug-related search and arrest warrants when Andrew Brown was shot. Nearby Dare County issued arrest warrants for Brown on drug-related charges, including possession with intent to sell cocaine. Andrew Brown had a criminal history dating to the 1990s, including previous drug convictions. Recordings of scanner traffic compiled by Broadcastify.com website include emergency personnel indicating that Andrew Brown was shot in the back. An eyewitness has said deputies fired as he tried to drive away. A car removed from the scene of the incident appeared to have multiple bullet holes and a shattered back window. In scanner recordings, a woman refers to the address where the warrant was served and can be heard to say, "We are responding. Law enforcement on scene advises shots fired. Need emergency medical services." A male voice says, "Emergency medical services has got one male, 42 years of age, gunshot to the back. We do have viable pulse at this time." Someone then says first responders are trying to resuscitate the man. Tommy Wooten, the district attorney, and the state medical examiner have yet to respond to requests for comment on the scanner recordings. North Carolina's Bureau of Investigation also declined to comment. Andrew Brown's death came just days after former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was convicted of murder in the death of George Floyd. And amid national controversy over the police shooting deaths of Duante Wright, a 20-year-old in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, on 11th of April, and Makia Bryant, a 16-year-old teenager in Ohio, last Tuesday. In Elizabeth City on Thursday, protesters demanded to be told why deputies opened fire in a residential area. "They fired a shot in a school zone," said Quentin Jackson, regional director of the National Black Caucus of local elected officials. Quentin Jackson added, "When does this stop? When does it stop?" Meanwhile, Andrew Brown's family and relatives described him as humorous, always having a nice joke and a great heart. His relatives said he was quick to crack a joke at family gatherings he tried not to miss after losing both of his parents. He encouraged his children to make good grades, even though he dropped out of high school himself. Above all, he was determined to give them a better life than he had. The 42-year-old from Elizabeth City, North Carolina, was shot to death on Wednesday, 21st of April, by a deputy sheriff trying to serve a search warrant. An eyewitness said Andrew Brown tried to drive away but was shot dead in his car. The shooting has resulted in protests and demands for accountability in the eastern North Carolina city, Elizabeth City, a city of about 18,000 population.
The subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Don, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the region of South Asia, which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we are going to talk about Russian Foreign Minister's visit to India and Pakistan, as well as its significance for the geopolitics of Asia. And we shall take a look at the recent nationwide protests in Pakistan and why Islamabad banned a hardline religious group in the country.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently visited India and then went to Pakistan. Lavrov's visit may herald a new era of ties with the subcontinent. Apart from the significance of Moscow's move to mend the frayed relations with the Asian countries, the visits can potentially impact Washington's policies regarding Islamabad and New Delhi.
Earlier this month, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov took a two-day trip to India, where he met his Indian counterpart, Subramaniam Jaishankar. Lavrov then traveled to Pakistan from New Delhi. Moscow says a special and privileged strategic partnership with India is one of Russia's foreign policy priorities. And during their joint press conference, the two foreign ministers reiterated the time-tested nature as well as the remarkable resilience of their bilateral ties in the face of the increasing difficulties that have marred their relations in recent times. 2020 was especially troubled for India-Russia ties as their annual summit was cancelled for the first time in two decades. Although the respective ministries said that the summit was cancelled because of the COVID-19 pandemic, some reports speak of more other reservations, because throughout the pandemic, India held bilateral and multilateral meetings virtually with other partners. Jaishankar and Lavrov talked about the International North-South Transport Corridor and the Chennai-Vladivostok Eastern Maritime Corridor. But many believe that the focus of Lavrov's visit to the region was on the Afghanistan peace process. In Islamabad, Lavrov said that Russia and Pakistan had convergent positions on the Afghan peace process.
All right, now let's look at the map of Asia. The North-South Transport Corridor is the 72,000-kilometer-long multimode network of ship, rail and road routes for moving freight between Russia, Azerbaijan, Iran and India. The objective of the corridor is to increase trade connectivity between major cities such as Mumbai, Moscow and Tehran, among others. Traditionally, the Indo-Russian strategic partnership has been built on five major components: politics, defense and military equipment, civil nuclear energy, anti-terrorism cooperation and space technology. However, in recent years, a sixth economic component has grown in importance, with both countries setting a target of reaching $30 billion in bilateral trade by 2025, from about $9.4 billion in the year 2017. India is the second largest market for Russian defense industry. In 2017 alone, approximately 68% of Indian military hardware came from Russia, making Russia the chief supplier of defense equipment. According to a poll in 2014, almost 85% of Russians viewed India positively, while only 9%, a very small chunk, viewed them negatively. Similarly, a 2017 opinion poll by the